Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health. Rachel Naomi Remen, MD, professor and author of Kitchen Table Wisdom, said about today's guest, "When it comes to our health, our choices are often our destiny. In deep medicine, Dr. Stewart supports our choices with the skill of a surgeon and the wisdom of a healer. William B. Stewart, MD, is the author of the incredible book, Deep Medicine, and is co-founder and medical director of the Institute for Health and Healing at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. He has been voted by his peers as one of the best doctors in America for many years through the Best Doctors Incorporated organization. Dr. Stewart's work has been informed by medical volunteer work in India and more than 30 years of surgical practice. His personal experiences have contributed to a profound perspective on the cycles of life and the principles and practices of mindful living. Dr. Stewart, welcome to It's Your Health.
Thank you, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm so glad that you're here. I thoroughly enjoyed your book, and I highly recommend it. It's wonderful. Now, in the foreword, Angelus Arian writes, Dr. Stewart's most compelling message is, quote, "Everything is either health-creating or health-negating." Can you tell us more about this?
I can. I think we often look at our health and trivialize it, break it into very tiny parts, which are represented by our symptoms or how we might be feeling on any given day. And yet the reality of our health is that every issue is a health issue. Not only are our physical symptoms, but how we are engaging our colleagues and our friends and our family and the world, our relationships are health issues. How we are doing our work or expressing our creativity in the world is a health issue. How we look at our resources, either the lack or the abundance that we have, is a health issue. Everything is a health issue. Social justice is a health issue. Environmental degradation is a health issue. Poverty is a health issue. And when we take this bigger picture, I think it helps us put our personal symptoms into a connection or context of everything that's going on around us.
Okay, now, you came to this thinking, I believe, from a visit to India. Now, how long ago was that? And is that when you began to think about deep medicine in this way?
Well, as India and the experiences in India were very significant in kind of molding my health-related philosophy. And I first went to India to work as a surgeon in 1983. And had the real honor of working with Dr. Govindava Venkataswamy at the Aravind Eye Hospitals in India. And Dr. Venkataswamy began these hospitals really after his retirement as chair of ophthalmology in a local medical school, because he felt that the service that his countrymen was getting with regard to their vision was not enough. And blindness in India is really a life-threatening disease because people can't work, they can't see to put food on their table for themselves or their family. So his desire to stamp out needless blindness was a very powerful spiritual motivation to serve his countrymen around needless blindness. And the group of family and others that he gathered around him have led to the creation of the world's largest eye care system. And it was an eye-opening reality for a young, full of himself surgeon to go to India and see the magnificent work that they were doing of high volume and high quality. So it definitely impacted my view of what healthcare and the practice of medicine was all about.
And when you returned, what did you do? What did you... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I wish it was that simple, but I was definitely moved by that initial experience, both to continue to do work, medical volunteer work in India, and also to think about how we could bring some of the energy that I saw in operant in India back to the advanced biotechnical medicine that was practiced in the States.
So prior to your going then, you were an ophthalmologist, is that correct?
Well, I was trained in ophthalmology, but I also had significant training in general surgery and in reconstructive surgery around the eye. So I definitely was an ophthalmologist, but my practice was very much limited to reconstructive surgery around the eye. So I did work with tumors behind the eye, reconstruction of the eyelids because of either trauma or cancer, degenerative changes around the eye, congenital changes. So it was definitely related to ophthalmology, but sort of beyond what usually people are considering ophthalmology. And the reason I first went to India is because the people at the Aravind Eye Hospital were expanding their world of surgical care around the eye beyond cataract and glaucoma, the vision-threatening aspects of ophthalmology, to these more broader specialties. And that, my specialty brought me to India, but what moved me was the compassion and the care and the energy that these fine surgeons and physicians and caregivers brought to their work.
So you were able to bring that back to your work then when you returned, I guess is a better question, and the energy. And by energy, what can you define that a little bit?
Well, it was very clear in India that the amount of work that was being done was not motivated entirely by the paycheck at the end of the month. There was a great compassion and caring for the people that were cared for, and they were cared for regardless of what caste they were in, regardless of their ability to pay. They were encouraged to pay what they could, and care was rendered to them. And the volume of work that was done was absolutely mind-boggling. And yet, the surgeons and the people who were giving care had a reservoir of energy that was clearly coming to them kind of beyond their physical capacities. And this could be called a spiritual energy or a motivation that was beyond themselves. And to capture that in the more developed world was something that really intrigued me. And I have to say that from my days as a young schoolboy, that I really have had a great interest in science and the scientific approach, but also in the philosophic approach and what exists beyond the boundaries of what we can understand or see scientifically. So I had an appreciation really for the unseen world and how it influences us in our daily life.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you brought up the spiritual side, because when I was reading your book, I was really, you know, amazed that you were talking about the spiritual aspects of an illness, and I've never heard a doctor talk about that. And what are spiritual aspects of an illness? What does that mean?
Well, I think there's no question that illness manifests by and large as physical issues. We have pain, or we have symptoms that are related to a certain organ system, whether it's a headache or a backache or pain in our belly or shortness of breath. And often our first attempt at explaining an illness is to look for very physical causes. Is it an infection? Is it an injury? What is the determining factor? Could it be an obstruction in a blood vessel? Could it be an ulcer in our stomach? When we begin to look beyond those physical manifestations, we begin to encounter certain things that we know are contributing to our illness. For example, the most helpful predictor of success in heart surgery is the efficiency with which the heart is beating, what is called ventricular ejection fraction. But the second most significant predictor of how somebody is going to have to do after, how somebody is going to do after heart surgery, is the presence of depression. So depression is a great health risk factor, just like how the heart pump is working is a risk factor. It's also known that many subtle energies, if you will, contribute to when we get sick. Some people who are exposed to a virus or a bacteria, for example, on a long airplane flight with many, many people breathing the same air, some people become ill and some people don't. So there are a great number of physical and other factors that are impacting our well-being. And these include the state of our mental health and our emotions and our well-being beyond what can be measured, say, by our temperature and our blood pressure and our weight, but may be measured by what we're thinking or how we're feeling. And those are the kinds of issues that deep medicine deals with in addition to the physical issues. I don't think we can separate the two. Just like the most common time for a heart attack in a man of working age is Monday morning. And that's more than just all the blood clots deciding that they're going to make their move when the alarm goes off.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, let me tell you, I mean, stress and illness, I mean, what you're talking about and the emotions of stress. I was told, I mean, I've had some, a lot of stressors in my life from my daughter who has some complicated special needs. And I was, about a couple years ago, I had this great homeopath and naturopath, and she said, you have adrenal fatigue. And I was like, oh, but I do yoga, I take care of myself. And she said, yeah, but the stress is really getting to you. And so I've had to find ways. And that's what's so great about your book, is really trying to learn ways to manage the stress and to see health in a larger way that you're talking about.
Yeah, we all understand that stress can be positive. It can stimulate us to perform well and to show up. But when it's chronic, it can become detrimental, and it can involve any of the bodily systems. It can affect our thinking. It can make us anxious. It can make us depressed. It can cause us insomnia. It can cause us to want to sleep all the time, and we have to be very individualized in our approach to stress. And that's why many of the programs that are offered to people for their own well-being and for their self-help can be a little bit generic. And one of the things that I really encourage people to do in deep medicine is to begin their own personal self-study. And that's a lifelong project. And as enamored as we are with the idea of a quick fix, health is, and our well-being and our recovery from illness are lifelong projects. They're like, they all often make fun of road work in India, saying that the roads are constantly being repaired and fixed and worked on, but they never finish. And managing our health is a bit like that too. It's a dynamic exercise, and no matter how good we feel at any given moment, we don't know what's coming around the next corner. That's one of the great haunting realities of our life, is it's always unpredictable and uncertain, which is a real argument for being mindful, for living in the present, not worrying too much about what's going to happen in the future, or letting memories of what's happened in the past completely dominate our time in the present. We must learn from our experiences. We must course correct. We must plan ahead. But also, we need to be fully present in the moment to engage what's happening right now. And that's one of the messages in deep medicine also.
Yeah, you know, I find that very difficult. I'm listening to you, and I'm just thinking, oh, my gosh, this is what I need to do, what I've been trying to do, and I'm sure many of my listeners as well. How can someone become more mindful?
The challenge of doing almost any of the things that it is suggested that we do is a very significant one. You know the lovely little story about five frogs are sitting on a log and four frogs decide to jump off?
Yes.
How many frogs are left on the log?
Oh, yeah.
All five are left on the log because deciding to jump off and jumping off are two different things.
Right.
So it is what you describe, the fact that we often know what to do, but translating that into action is extremely challenging. So the message, I think, of that is we have to be able to really accurately place ourselves. And by that I mean assess where we are right now. So as you know, in the book, I suggest four kind of starter questions that we each can ask ourselves multiple times during the day. And these questions first came to me in a book by a psychologist, Wyatt Webb, who worked with troubled teenagers for many, many years. And he wrote a lovely little book called It's Not About the Horse. And Wyatt Webb was one of the people who started equine therapy around many health-related conditions. And the four kind of basic questions that he suggested are, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? What am I doing about it? And how is it working? And so these questions we can ask ourselves many times during the course of a day. And as we begin to answer them honestly, it is a practice in our own self-study. And self-study is critically important because it requires self-reflection. It requires looking carefully at ourselves. And when we do that, we gain a great deal of self-knowledge. And from this knowledge, we can begin to take the first small steps toward those health-related goals that we desire.
Yeah, you know, you also talk about in your book about the stages of change and making changes and lifestyle, the power of lifestyle choices. And, you know, I used to be a health and lifestyle coach, and my primary focus was, you know, moving folks from a processed food diet to a whole foods diet. And again, the person really needed to be in touch with what they wanted to follow through, because it's really hard to make a change if you're not ready or if you're not in touch with yourself. So I just wanted to say that is so important.
Oh, I fully agree with you. And one of the things that also is emphasized in deep medicine is the reality that choosing the specific diet, because we know a great deal now about nutrition and about diet, and there are lots of experts out there and wonderful books that can guide us. But the truth of the matter is the underlying need is how we go about making change. It's a little bit like if somebody is learning how to play golf, and even before they actually know how to play golf, they're going to the golf store to buy clubs. So which set of clubs we buy, which diet we might go on, which exercise plan we might go on, is less important than knowing how to play the game. And the game around health creation and peak performance and optimal aging is around how we make choices and changes in our lives. So practices that will lead us to good choice and good decision making, and practices that will guide us and serve us in initiating and sustaining change, are common regardless of which program or protocol or plan we're on.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, completely. Yeah, you know, one of the things that, well, I've liked a lot of things about your book, but in your chapter, The Challenge of Change, you have a quote from Charles Darwin that says, "It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change." And that's exactly what, you know, we've been talking about. And it is really, you know, I got an email from somebody who actually wasn't, I'll be honest, who wasn't too happy with me. I was talking about, you know, in January, I'm devoting the whole month to people who've made incredible changes in their health. And I put something, you know, in there about, you know, incredible weight loss stories. And this woman said, well, you know, what about the emotional side? And you see all these before and after pictures, but what about that? And it really got me thinking, that's a huge part. And getting in touch with yourself, like you're talking about, and getting in touch with the emotions, that's what's going to take to make the change.
Yeah, I think, again, the title of Deep Medicine really refers to that. Very, very often, Our health change is defined or guided by kind of a quick fix mentality. We can go on a stringent diet and lose a lot of weight, and I give great honor to people who do that. Now, beyond the initial weight loss is the challenge to sustain that weight loss mm-hmm. over time. And as you well know, this is a very challenging reality because the vast majority of people who do take off weight gain it back again. So in so much as we can define underlying issues, that we can not only put ourselves in the driver's seat of our vehicle, but take the responsibility when a warning light goes on the dashboard to look under the hood, as my colleague Michael Cantwell is so fond of saying. It's not just about painting the walls. It's about going deep enough to get the mold out of the walls before you paint it. And it's a little bit like most of our experience with, say, the ocean is at the beach. We see the very edge of the ocean where it comes in touch with the land, and we see the surface wave action. But we really understand little or nothing about the ocean if we're only seeing the beach and the waves. And that's part of the challenge brought forward in deep medicine. It's getting a deeper, inner, wise look at our signs and symptoms, and that doesn't necessarily require years of therapy or 6 months on a desert island. It may require that for you, but also we can gain great insight by simple self-questioning and an honest self-negotiation about what it is that is really important to me. Because there are really only two reasons that we ever make a change. I think all our reasoning boils down to something that we really, really want or something that we really, really don't want are the two things that motivate us and guide us toward change. And in so much as we can come to a self-appreciation or a self-understanding through our self-study, then we can much more effectively and sustainably move forward in changing or giving up our so-called bad habits related to our health and substituting them with something good and health-creating.
Yeah, well, what's so great about your book, too, is that you give ways to make these things happen. You know, it's very, very helpful. Now, I wanted to ask, as we only have a few minutes left, I wanted to ask, what is the deep minute? Because I think that's important.
Well, the deep minute really is an exercise that I began doing with young surgeons in training many years ago because we were all very, very busy and spent long days in the hospital, in the operating room, and often we'd come together at the end of the day for a lecture or a discussion about my area of specialty, which was reconstructive surgery around the eye. And most everybody had missed a meal, been up late, been working for 8, 10, 12 hours perhaps, and was very, very tired. And in order to come together for that next hour that we were going to spend together, I began using just 1 minute by the clock for us to sit quietly and breathe gently in and out in kind of a moment of relaxation. Now, most meditation techniques encourage you to spend 20 minutes several times a day or longer periods of time. But even with 1 minute of quiet respite from the daily grind, we can experience physiologic changes in that our pulse can slow, our blood pressure can fall, our breathing rate can modulate, our mind can quiet, and we can come together in the present. So that was the genesis of the concept of a deep minute, sort of speed dating for meditation, so that even in very brief periods of time, we can get a taste of what wisdom is available to us physically, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, even in an extremely short period of time. And hopefully that taste leads us to spending more time in meditative or contemplative practices and broadening our knowledge base and what we know about ourselves, which then can lead us through self-negotiation and frequent self-assessment toward the goals that we desire.
You know, I've always found meditating to be really difficult because I think they call it monkey mind or monkey mind. Anybody who listens to the show is like, yeah, Lisa, we get that. But anyway, I think that's a nice way to start, because I listen to that and think, I could do it for a minute and then get better at that for a while, and then, well, maybe I could do it for 5 minutes, you know? So
yeah, and somebody like you who wants to be active and who likes to move, you may find that the way for you to begin a practice of quieting the inner landscape so that you can actually hear your wisdom might begin with walking meditation. Mm-hmm. So that rather than plant yourself where your mind is going wild, if you begin your meditative practice with a quiet walk and ask yourself the question that you're working on, so that as you walk and as your mind quiets, the wisdom within can bring you potentially to a solution. That's one of the things where something like, say, a labyrinth can be so powerful to somebody who doesn't like sitting still but would rather be moving.
Oh, I like that. That's really
good. There are ways that we can determine for ourselves, or through guidance from mentors and coaches and experts and others, find ways that work for us. The self-directed plan, as I indicated in the book, is the statistically most successful for people. When we're taking the responsibility of determining for ourselves what it is we need, we have a greater potential to succeed on our path.
You are so inspirational. You have to come back, because we're just about done. I wanted to make sure you had a minute, though, to tell us about the Institute for Health and Healing. I'm at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco.
Well, the Institute for Health and Healing is an expression of holistic healthcare in a mainstream leadership medical institution. The roots of the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco go back to before the Civil War, where it was one of the first medical schools west of the Mississippi River, and it has always been a leadership institution in San Francisco. And recently, the medical center adopted a new tagline to describe how it approaches healthcare in the community, and that tagline is Beyond Medicine. And the Institute for Health and Healing supports that promise to the community by bringing spiritual care, bedside massage, guided imagery, expressive arts, integrative medicine clinic classes to our staff, to our patients, and to the general community in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Well, I'm from California. I'm from San Jose. And let me tell you, next time I visit, I'm coming up to check it out. I think I'll try that massage.
Well, we'd love to have you come and visit, and I'd be delighted to come back and talk to you anytime it serves your needs.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, it's funny, because when I was in the car, I was looking at the person who's coming up next is actually, her name is Carolyn Coker Ross, MD, MPH, and she wrote a book called The Binge Eating and Compulsive Overeating Workbook. And I was looking at the book side by side, and they both have the same little seal. It says Whole Body Healing. And I thought, oh, this is great. They're both from the same publisher, and she talks a lot about the importance of getting in touch with yourself as well. So whether someone has an eating disorder or not, I would really recommend people keep listening, because it helped me with some of my issues that have nothing to do with food. And so I would encourage you to keep listening. And I'm really glad you got to listen today. And if you were not able to listen to this show live, or if you were and you want to tell your friends, they can catch it on my site. It's yourhealthradio.org on Friday. Everyone, keep being healthy. Have a great week. Take care. Bye-bye.